From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells. OSearch has just returned from their 40th ocean research expedition that was off the coast of the Carolinas. Now, this is an area they had not explored before. They collaborated with 42 scientists from 28 research institutions. They collected data for 23 science projects. Joining us now is Chris Fisher. He's the founder. He's the chairman of OSearch. Chris, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you back on the program. For our listeners that are not familiar with OSearch, can you take a minute or two and describe what you all do and why you do it?
Sure. I think that, you know, the obvious thing most people are see is what we do. And so we capture the largest apex predators in the ocean for science communities so that we can solve the puzzle of their lives. Things like great white sharks, right? Where are they mating? Where do they give birth? What's their full migratory path? Where are the females gestating? Once they are born, where is the nursery and how do they move through it? So it's basically documenting the life of a white shark from the moment it's born to the moment it's died. So we have the information to manage them back from the brink of extinction, because we were down to about 9% of our populations. And without this data set now, we could not return them to abundance, right? We couldn't help the baby survive in the nursery. We couldn't facilitate and give them space and mating, and also give those big females that time they need to gestate. So, right, if you don't know where that is, you can't affect it. So that's what we do. But I do think that the bigger question is really, why do we do it? Because believe it or not, like, I'm not a shark guy. I grew up in Kentucky chasing fish and frogs around the woods and really had a passion for the ocean and recreational fishing, and started to see years ago that we didn't have our fishermen helping our scientists, and our scientists were suffering from what they call data deficit. We don't have the data to manage back and we're running out of time. And quite simply, it's because we just didn't have our best practical and academic knowledge coming together on a common vision, which was to create and collect that data so that our kids see an abundant ocean. And it's mostly system driven, not individually driven. So we built a new enterprise. We built an enterprise where, you know, the scientists have no boats, no money, and can't catch what they study. All that funding has gone to different programs over the many decades of the past. And so they don't have any capacity, and they're all competing against one another. So we were like, well, hey, wait a minute. Why don't we come together with big capacity, a ship and a lift? Because the scientists were saying, if we don't have a lot of large sharks, there will be no fish for our kids to see in the ocean. So we had to pursue the data set, which is what we do. But the why and the how we do it is because if we bring those sharks back and their numbers back, the system is in balance and there's plenty of food for the future. And how we do it and accelerate the rate of learning and overcome this data deficit and their lack of funding is to build a new enterprise where we have a ship and we just give it to them all. And that ship comes with a world-class crew of professional watermen that know how to move around the world and know how to capture and release large things and let them go live. And then the science community really can just explode their rate of learning from there. Really simple, you know, so obvious, should have been done a long time ago. The system of grants and publisher parish and the distrust between the fishing community and the science community didn't really, you know, get those communities coming together. So it's like, we need a new type of environmental leadership. We need people who are centrists. We need people who can bring people together on a common vision. We need solution-oriented people, not position-oriented people. And so really just trying to rise up in that space in a loud way, in a centrist way, say, come on, man, we got no more time for that. Our grandkids got no more time for that. Let's come together. Let's get it done. And that is how we do it. And that's what gets me excited, right? This is about fish sandwiches for our grandkids. We must win this one.
Exactly. And one of the themes that Lynn and I continue to see over our 9-year period, our 9-year run on Cool Science Radio, is that research used to be really siloed and it was not collaborative. And even with disparate groups like chemists and microbiologists, and you have taken that to a completely new level, because you really encourage, you really push these scientists. I mean, as I look at the 23 science projects, you have several people on a project that used to compete with each other, and now they're all sharing data together. You don't monetize the data. The data goes out to the public domain, and you're just really trying to push this thing forward. So you say it should have been done a long time ago, but your model is very unique, and we don't see that as much. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, for me, when this whole thing began, when we pivoted to help these scientists solve this more complicated questions, you know, back in 2007, the amount of effort and capital, you got to remember, I studied entrepreneurship at Indiana University and the National University of Singapore, man. So you're talking about trying to build efficient enterprises, right? You don't win in the private sector if you don't have an efficiently operating enterprise. Well, then I began to help these people in the research space. And this is the exact opposite of efficient. It is totally inefficient, right? So it's making me crazy. The other thing is I come from this fishing background and I do a little bird hunting. And so tremendous, I think, ethos from that community to honor the beast. Like if you're going to capture something, if you're going to touch something, you have an obligation to maximize whatever you're trying to do with that event. If it's to eat it, then you need to eat it all, right? If it is to learn from it, then you need to learn as much as you can and honor that beast if you're going to capture it. So the first time we went out in 2007 and we proved it was possible, we went down, we did one thing to the shark and let it go. And I'm like, we need 20 more smart people here right now. It costs no more money to do 22 more research projects on top of this as it does to do one. And more, so that's efficiency, right? When we're talking about an environment where everyone's complaining about data deficit and time, efficiency should be the pursuit, right? But also for me, when we captured that animal and we did that, I said, look, if we're gonna do this and honor the beast, if it's gonna be shark first, we have an obligation to look, figure out all the science we must learn about this animal to be able to manage it back to abundance. Let's create that list, right? Now, every time we catch one, we need to be contributing to the data set to knock out that list in the most efficient way possible. So we have the data set touching the fewest amount of sharks, right? That is shark first. That is ocean first. That is efficient. But unfortunately, in the academic space, that is hearsay, right? So we were forced to just charge it in a different way. Fortunately, some of the leaders in the community really got into collaborating. All the young people totally get it, right? They're growing up with a different mindset. But this idea of individual silos and me against you and publish or perish is what caused the data deficit problem. So, you know, what are we going to do? Keep doing the same thing and expect a different result? So we got to shock the system. We got to do the obvious. We got to collaborate. We got to bring the practical, the academic together and do it in a selfless way that is shark first. And, you know, and it just kind of became its own thing. Just, and all the time along the way, I got to tell you this, we didn't have any sort of diabolical plan for OSearch when we started. I thought that it was going to become what it has become, right? Like, all we tried to do every time they said they needed help was be like, what's the most ocean first, shark first way to do this? Great grandchildren first. When we didn't know what to do, that was the test, even when it was inconvenient. And that is what shaped the organization and led us to where we are today.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Chris Fisher. As he said, he grew up in Kentucky. He's a Park City resident, at least part-time. And he is the founder and director of OSearch. It's a huge ocean-going vessel that studies sharks. In this most recent, the 40th expedition of the Carolinas, 23 science projects with 42 scientists from 28 different institutions. And, you know, Chris, I opened up the science brief that explains all of the different projects. If you're not a scientist, it's a little bit hard to decipher, but I just picked out a few to look at just so our listeners can really get an idea of what you're doing, there's one project. It's called The Physiological Effects of Capture Stress in the White Shark, which is a little bit what you're talking, what you've been talking about in the last few minutes, and to lessen the amount of stress. But there are scientists from Disney's Animal Science and Environment. Who knew, right? New York Aquarium, Stony Brook University, Jacksonville University, and the Moat Marine Laboratory on OSearch. It's just fascinating, all these institutions coming together and creating this collaboration that is, you know, I mean, I don't know how much you know about this particular study, but can you talk a little bit to that?
Oh, I know that one very well. I mean, that's led by our chief veterinarian, Dr. Harley Newton, who is like one of the most brilliant veterinarians we've worked with anywhere around the world. And the team of people, like you said, across multiple institutions that all have a little bit of a different specialty, primarily analyzing the blood samples we get from the sharks. So what we're trying to do is, Captain Brett's challenge, what really gets him excited is, he's trying to deliver a shark to the cradle under zero stress level, right? So now this would be an opportunity for the science community to understand what all of these baseline levels of various things in their blood and other things should be when they're just completely in the wild cruising around. Of course, you can always say, well, they'd always have some level of stress on them because, you know, maybe it's temperature, maybe they're, you know, in pursuit of something, maybe they're injured. But, you know, the idea is let's try to get a baseline on what their blood sample looks like with as minimum impact as possible. And so we've had multiple times where we get some of these smaller white sharks, you know, maybe at 1200 pounds, 1000 pounds, and he will literally, it will pick up a bait and he will have it in the cradle in like 3 minutes. So there's no stress level. Right then, Dr. Newton and her team, they get a blood sample immediately. It's the first thing we do. And then that goes into the lab and it's being run up sometimes in real time to understand the stress level that that shark is under, particularly if it was like a bigger shark or more complicated, maybe it got tangled or something and she was concerned. She would get an immediately blood level and say, come out and say, you know, let it go. We've never had to do that. But we do are always trying to be way overly cautious, right? You never want to be surprised. And then we'll do all of those research projects over the course of about 15 minutes. And then the last thing we do is take another blood sample. Right now it allows them to compare the values of the blood sample, the stress it took to capture it, to get it in the heart, which is the baseline of the first sample. And then the impact of the procedures that we did on the shark over the 15 minutes, the variation between those two is also demonstrating the impact on the animal while we do all of the various research projects prior to dropping it right in the water and letting it go. So we have learned some really fascinating things already about this, some of which has been published, a bunch more. We have 55 peer-reviewed papers published, but we got another like 40 getting ready to pop. And I've been going through like the final reviews, a bunches of them over the last couple weeks. Very interesting, the stress levels of the animals when we bring them into the cradle, very low. One of the things we've learned about capturing these animals, and this is where the fishing and the science, like the practical and the academic, really collide for the shark. Captain Brett starts really getting into these stress levels. So now the guy I know who's in charge, my fishing master, he's not just thinking about how do I catch this shark? He's thinking about how do I catch this shark and not have it almost not even know I caught it, right? So when you unleash his mind with his expertise in that practical space, it gets really interesting, right? The guy's a savant on the water. And so now he's like, hey, can we put a device in the line so I can see how hard the animal picks up the bait and how hard I need to pull on it to maybe turn its head? And so now he's getting measurements actually in his line that he's holding between his hands and the shark, understanding certain data metrics and when is pulling too hard, when is not enough. I mean, we're going deep, right? We're going into things like people haven't even thought about. And he's been able now where a shark will pick up a bait. And if the boat is over maybe a quarter mile away, he won't even let the animal know that it's caught because it'll pick up the bait and start walking away. He'll pick up the buoys so quietly and so gently that it doesn't even know he's there. And then if he needs to get it to go in a certain direction, he just barely tugs on its face and puts it in a turn until it's swimming back to the ship. And then he takes all the pressure off it. And it's like walking a dog back to the ship on a loose line, right? On a loose leash. And so then when we get it, it swims right back to the cradle, then boom, boom, we put buoys on it and put it in the cradle and it doesn't even know what happened, right? And we're seeing these stress levels that they're blowing the veterinarians' minds. Like, but who would put that together without this collaborative, multidisciplinary, practical and academic coming together? So very low stress levels, it taught us a lot about basically, we don't really catch sharks anymore. We quickly train them. You know, it's more like teaching a dog how to heal. And then what we're seeing so we're getting them with real low stress levels. Look, when you catch a 4,000 pound white shark in 40 minutes, it's chosen to give up. It's not tired. I mean, it could fight you for 2, 3, 4 days if it wanted to, right? When you get it into the cradle in 40 minutes, it is because it's allowing you to put it in the cradle.
Yeah.
We train them more than catch them. And then when we're in the cradle itself, the interesting thing between these first sample and the second sample is we're seeing about half of the animal's stress levels go down. They're actually recovering in the cradle from what it took to get them into the cradle. Because we got great ventilation on their gills, I think, and the same condition of learned helplessness that we use to get them in there, right? They just give up. They let us put them in there. They know that. That's why you don't see them flopping around on the deck much, right? They're not doing that. They just kind of lay there. And so about 50% of the animals, like their oxygen levels go up, their stress levels go down, 25% stay about the same, 25% slightly rise. So we know we got the impact on the shark, anything that might really impacted, absolutely minimized, way below any sort of alert levels. And that's just a few details about the project you asked about. Sorry, on and on. But it's like, it's not so simple as just the project, right? Like if you don't got the fisherman talking to the vet, totally like big picture. Hey doc, what are we trying to learn here? Oh, I can change the way I catch it to help you out. Oh, I'm totally into that. Let you know, people aren't even having those conversations until now. And that's where the breakthroughs come.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you quickly about the practical application of this. When you see that, you know, Disney animals are participating in this and various aquariums, you know, recently there have been, you know, entire documentaries based on animals in captivity and how they shouldn't be held. And so what the practical application of this, I would think, is that you can go to aquariums and say, listen, this is the research that we found, and this is either why or why not, or how you can better keep these animals in captivity, is if that's even what we're going to do.
This whole thing about animals in captivity is absurd. The person who probably made the film fell in love with animals at a zoo or an aquarium. You know, so how are our children going to fall in love with things that they can't go visit around the world? Nobody wants to save the forest they can't walk in. You know, these places, they have the most advanced science. So when we need help in the wild, we know how to apply what we've learned and manage care to the water, right? So the same person who complains about them calls them first time they need help. Right. You know, so we got to get real about this. We got to grow up. We got to have solution oriented centrists in these conversations. That's why I'm talking about a new type of environmental leadership. We need a practical. Are we really going to sit here and talk about aquariums and zoos when our whole species survival program depends on restocking the planet from those facilities? Should we have some sort of catastrophe?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Come on, man. You know, so you look, we got to pioneer the science so we can learn as much about the ones in the wild, and we can learn maybe what their levels and their diet needs to be to make them as comfortable as we can for the minuscule percentage that's in managed care, right? We need to learn as much from the ones in managed care so if we have a problem in the wild, we know how to treat it to maybe make it less of a catastrophe. Right. This is a commonsensical approach. Those animals are cared for. They get world class care in 99% of the facilities. So, I mean, I'm sorry, but this is what I'm talking about when we talk about we need to get real, man. We got a new type of environmental leadership. We need to make sure the forests and the oceans are full of fish for our children so that the planet system is operating and we have food, water, and air.
Right. Chris, I wanted to ask you, about 2.5 years ago, a 10-foot, 4-inch female, mature female, Surreal, was tagged off the African coast in Mozambique and was detected via satellite in April 2020, about 800 miles off the Indonesian coast, meaning that it traveled more than 4,000 miles, which is the longest confirmed migration for any species, for this species on record. You and I spoke a month later in May about Surreal. What is she up to? Is she pinged again?
You know, she was tagged by one of our partners over in Australia and South Africa that are working on these projects with various other species of sharks moving back and forth. Mm-hmm. I believe they did hear from her, but it's been some time ago. But, you know, what we see when we look at the genetics and particularly of white sharks, and you're thinking about these big ocean crossings, right? That impacts genetics over millions mm-hmm. of years. So when I talk, our main guy working on genetics is Dr. Gavin Naylor down at the University of Florida. He says that that we can identify all the different white shark populations across the world genetically, but you can see that there's commonality in some of them, which equates to, you know, kind of one shark. All they got to do is cross that big ocean once every third generation. And right. over the duration of time, we're going to end up with very similar genetics. So we do know that these large, massive crossings have done just from the science. It's not quite as dramatic as when you actually see a track unfold.
Right.
But really what we're seeing is what the genetics told us, but it's the first time we've actually gotten a track of those types of things occurring.
Yeah, exactly. The thing that amazes me is that we've been on the planet, humans, about 300,000 years. Sharks first appeared on Earth 450 million years ago, which is 210 million years before dinosaurs. And the question I have for you is, one of the studies on your expedition was studying the microbiome of sharks. Now, we know as humans that we have 70 trillion human cells, 70 trillion non-human bacterial cells on our skin and inside of us. And our non-human half has a lot to do with our health. So I wanted to ask you, is there any evolutionary efficiency in the shark's microbiome? We know in the human side that we can change the gut microbiome and we can modify that and we can attack some diseases and things like that. These creatures have been around for so long. Tell us about what we can learn from shark's microbiome.
So when you dig in, this is an awesome question, right? This is the type of stuff that gets me all jacked up. So when you're trying to solve a puzzle that's never been solved before, a lot of times you got to dig back and start thinking like natural selection, 450 million years, the reward of efficiency through natural selection, where might that lead the shark if we're trying to figure out where it's mating, or genetic diversity? Are they going to be mating in places where they always go in small little groups? Are they going to be mating in places where they all collide together to maximize genetic diversity over 450 million years? Because that's your best path towards success, right? As far as species survival. These things have gone through that natural selection process now for so long that they have opted out of almost every inefficiency in their system through natural selection and only rewarding if the most efficient. So when you start to get into their microbiome and stuff like that, like their gut is way simpler than ours, much simpler. We have some stuff getting ready to publish on that out of Stony Brook that really surprised them. And also I think down in out of Atlanta, and one of the Georgia schools. Also they have this bacteria on their body that we believe is working with their immune system for rapid healing. So we have a multiple of different projects on this. Number one, we're collecting that bacteria off their body, off wounds on their body for new antibiotic development for humans, right? Because we're running out of antibiotics. We are also taking bacteria off their teeth, tongue, and gums, so that we identify what bacteria are in all of these different populations around the world, so that if there is an incident, we can tell the hospital which antibiotics to use to fight the specific bacteria that's in the mouths of the white sharks of that region. Because, you know, most limbs are lost and many of the lives are lost due to infection, not blood loss. And it's because they don't know how to treat that. So we've been able to identify that. We've already been able to identify like the East Coast hospitals, which ones to go with. But there's a lot going on there, and it's because of the ancientness of the animal. It's now a simple and efficient and a perfect thing that's been fine-tuned for 450 million years. It's way ahead of the natural selections in humans, right? Because we've been around for a much shorter period of time. So what can we learn from their much longer journey toward efficiency to apply to ourselves to help us now? So microplastics are also another thing that we're studying in these animals. And the reason why that's so important is because white sharks are the top of the food chain, right? So they are what we call bioaccumulators. Everything that gets consumed from one small animal up to a bigger one is accumulating in that bigger animal. And when you get to the top of the food chain, you are at the top of bioaccumulation, which gives you this real health kind of assessment of the whole ocean region, right? It's a big indicator of general ocean health. And so the microplastics are one of the things we're studying along with mercury's in this toxicology program. And we are seeing high levels of mercury in these animals. We are seeing microplastics all throughout these animals. And the most important thing here is going to be identify, you know, where those things are coming from. How do we slowly just cut the source off, right, in the midst of trying to clean it up?
Chris Fisher, chairman and founder of OSearch, we want to thank you again for joining us on Cool Science Radio. We look forward to the 41st expedition.
Thanks for having me. It's always fun.
Thanks always great to have you, Chris.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.